Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. Randall Balmer is professor of American religious history at Barnard College, Columbia University. A prolific writer and commentator on faith in America, he is the author of many books, including The Making of Evangelicalism, From Revivalism to Politics and Beyond, God in the White House, A History, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush, and is co-author of Religion in American Life, A Short History. He holds a Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary, a Ph.D. in Religion from Princeton, and is a member of the American Academy of Religion, the American Society of Church History, and the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Randall, welcome to the show today, and thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Carol. Good to be here.
Now, going through your extensive library of work, your articles, interviews, books, and so much more, I noticed a recurring theme of might be known as the radical right having hijacked, in quotes there, your evangelical faith. So perhaps the place to begin here on the Institute is to first learn some about evangelicalism. Could you share some of us with us some of your faith?
Sure. I first of all, I'd be happy to define the term. It really comes from the New Testament, properly speaking. That is the first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which are sometimes referred to as the Gospels.
Yeah.
Or good news, and written by the evangelists. So the term evangelical actually refers to the New Testament. In the 16th century, with Martin Luther, it came to be associated with Protestantism. And I think in America, it has even a more particular meaning. And historically, it came to America in an event that I call the Great Awakening, a revival that took place in the Atlantic colonies in the 1730s and 1740s. And there you have the confluence of what I call the three P's, the vestiges of New England Puritanism, the Scots-Irish Presbyterians in the Middle Colonies, and then finally Continental Pietism, which with its emphasis on a warm-hearted piety. And those all came together and formed what has become evangelicalism in America, certainly the most important social and religious movement in American history.
And, I mean, would you consider right now that perhaps, I mean, thank you so much for that explanation. I think that Americans today might take this word and perhaps misconstrue it or combine it with other traditions here. Have you found that there are any misconceptions of evangelicalism?
Oh, yes, a whole lot. I think ever since the rise of the religious right in the late 1970s, it has come to be conflated with right-wing politics, the people like James Dobson and Chuck Colson and I suppose Tony Perkins and some of these other folks. But getting back to your lead-in to the question, the first question, what I'm trying to do in my work in the last few years is to say, listen, you've got a whole long and proud tradition of evangelicalism in America. And if you look at it carefully, it does not by any means lean to the right politically. In fact, it leans quite decidedly to the left politically. And what we've seen in the last half century, and certainly since the late 1970s, is, in my judgment, a severe distortion not only of evangelicalism itself and the noble heritage that it takes from the 19th century, but I would argue a distortion of the New Testament as well.
Yes, and even the word puritanical has been sort of twisted as something derisive when that's not the original.
No, not necessarily. It's, yeah. There's nothing wrong with the word.
Well, commonly, I've found it's used usually as a sort of an accusation that someone is being intolerant.
Right.
So let's explore this a little bit more here in terms of development and growth in America.
Yes.
Let's discuss key figures and how it developed from that original time that you mentioned.
Well, there are a lot of it's a long and rich tradition in the 18th century. Probably the most identifiable figures would be people like George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, who really were the leaders of this revival called the Great Awakening that swept through the Atlantic colonies in the 1730s and 1740s. Hmm. In the 18th century, it would be very much associated with the early days of Methodism, the circuit riders, also with a theologian and preacher and social reformer, and that's, in my judgment, a crucial combination, named Charles Grandison Finney, who was a Presbyterian minister in upstate New York, and later became a professor of theology at Oberlin College in Ohio. And in the 20th century, probably the most recognizable figure certainly would be Billy Graham.
Right.
But there are many others as well. Billy Sunday before him, who was once a baseball player for the Chicago White Stockings baseball team, who went on to become a rather notable evangelist and preacher. Amy Semple McPherson, certainly women were involved, especially in the Pentecostal strain of evangelicalism. And I guess more recently, Rick Warren would come to mind.
Right.
Joel Osteen is a little bit of a special case. I'm not sure I'd be entirely comfortable putting him into that category, but he wouldn't be too far removed from that. And some of the mega churches and so forth would be associated with that.
Now, a couple of phrases you mentioned in there. Can you share a little bit what was the Great Awakening about and what inspired it?
Well, the Great Awakening was really a series of revivals that took place in the Atlantic colonies in the 1730s and 1740s. And this comes at a time when Puritanism in New England was very much on the wane, and many people, many historians refer to Jonathan Edwards, for example, as the last Puritan, and in some ways he was. He was a pastor at that time in Northampton, Massachusetts, and during the winter of 1734-1735, all of a sudden there was an interest in religion and religious conversions in his town. And Edwards was very careful to say that he did not bring it on. This was, in his judgment, a gracious visitation of the Holy Spirit, where people in the town were very much converted. And that, by the way, is one of the key components for understanding who an evangelical is. And if you'll permit me, I'll just take a side path here to say a little bit more about that.
Well, we don't have to take a side path because we have a whole hour.
Okay, good. A lot to talk about.
You can
about.
Take as long as you like, because I'd like to get into the subject of conversion, actually.
Let me just take a quick diversion from the Great Awakening to say that an evangelical, I think, is defined in three ways. First of all, somebody who takes the Bible, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, very seriously as God's revelation to humanity. And as a consequence, that person, more likely than not, will claim to interpret the Bible literally.
Right.
Although, as I've written elsewhere, I think evangelicals, like all of us, engage in what I call the ruse of selective literalism.
Mm-hmm.
Something we interpret literally, and others we don't. But I think that's probably human nature as much as anything else.
Right.
But if the Bible is central, then on the basis of evangelical readings of the Bible, the second characteristic is that an evangelical is somebody for whom the conversion moment or the conversion experience is central.
Yes.
And this comes from the third chapter of St. John in the New Testament, when Nicodemus, and actually I was just preaching on this morning in my church, Nicodemus visits Jesus by night to ask how he can enter the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus replies, "You must be born from above," or some versions, the King James Version in particular, says you must be born again. This is where the term comes from.
Right.
But for evangelicals, what this means is there is a moment in one's life very often dramatic and emotional, although it need not be. But there's a dateable experience when an evangelical can say, this is when I was converted or saved or born again, and those are all roughly synonymous terms, to connote a moment when you turn away from sin to salvation, from life, from death to life, and you embrace this new faith. And so that would be the second component of the definition. Finally, an evangelical is somebody who takes seriously what evangelicals call the Great Commission, when Jesus told his followers at the end of Mark's Gospel that they should go into all the world and preach the gospel and bring others into the faith. So an evangelical is somebody who wants to evangelize, or to use a less favored term, to proselytize, to bring others into the faith. So those would be the three components. Somebody who sees the Bible as God's revelation to humanity, much taken very, very seriously, even to the point of literal interpretation. Mm-hmm. Somebody who believes in the centrality of a conversion or born-again experience. And then finally, somebody who takes seriously the mandate to bring others into the faith.
Thank you so much for that answer. This is a fascinating conversation, and I want to just get a little more into conversion before we move on.
Sure.
If that's all right, because
yes,
from my perspective, this moment of conversion is something that, you know, it defines for me very much the Christian experience in particular.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk today about the religions in general, and you know, all great teachers, and you know what Buddhism offers and what all the religions offer, they each have their own particular thing that tends to define them, though. And rather than let's say a practice that would develop someone over time,
right?
This conversion, yes, can happen in one day, in one moment.
Yes.
And there is a death and resurrection and a life.
Yeah, that's right. And very often an evangelical will be able to recount with a great deal of detail and specificity the circumstances surrounding her or his conversion. They
right.
would say, for example, I was converted on June 17th, 1982. I was in the hospital. I was about to be taken in for surgery, and my roommate in the hospital read to me from the Psalms, and I decided at that moment to let Jesus into my heart. And that would be a fairly typical template for a conversion narrative for many people.
Yes, it's a deeply personal experience.
Personal, and it's also a dateable experience
for
most. Now, there's some evangelicals who would say, well, I came over time and so forth, and it was more gradual. But for most, there's a kind of a discernible moment when some sort of experience occurred.
Thank you. And now let's return to, we were talking about key figures
awakening.
And development along the way.
Right.
And you mentioned some folks today whose names, like including Rick Warren, that we recognize
right.
Along this path. So then what would you describe as the core beliefs? What is at the center then of evangelical life that would describe it as or differentiate it perhaps
sure.
from say
yeah.
another Christian denomination?
Well, I think I'd probably go back to my three P's because I think that there are elements of that you can still find within evangelicalism today. I think from the Puritans, what evangelicals retain is a sense of introspection, almost obsessive introspection. Mm. You remember the Puritans were always keeping diaries or journals to record their own spiritual experience, to record their own pilgrimage. In many ways, the classic Puritan text was John Bunyan's book, Pilgrim's Progress,
right.
where the central character, there's not much subtlety in Pilgrim's Progress. It's very, very clear imagery, where the central person is Christian, and he is traveling on this pathway toward heaven and encounters temptations and so forth along the way. Mm. And I think evangelicals retain that sense. They're always kind of taking their internal spiritual temperature to find out how they stack up, whether or not they are meeting the standards that are set forth in the Bible. So I think that's one of the things that evangelicals derive from Puritans. And I think from Presbyterians, many evangelicals at least have this sense of doctrinal precision, that is, making sure they hold the right doctrines.
Mm.
And this is where you get a lot of variation within evangelicalism, where some groups will say it's important to believe X, and others will say, well, it's more important that you believe Y, and believe me, there are a lot of rather fierce debates over these sorts of things, you know, such as the end of the world and apocalyptic belief and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But the importance of holding the right belief, I think, is something that evangelicals have inherited from the Presbyterians back in the colonial period. And then finally, from the Pietists, the importance of this warm-hearted, affective piety.
Mm.
That is, it's not enough merely to hold the right beliefs or doctrines. You have to be able to feel it. You have to be able to have this the subjective experience of Christ, of God.
You said warm-hearted?
Warm-hearted or affective. Very often emotional. And you get this, again, more emphasis in some groups than others. The Pentecostals tend to be very big on this sort of thing, whereas the fundamentalists tend to be more suspicious of emotion, and they would define themselves more with the specificity of their theology and their doctrine.
There's so much to discuss here. What you're sharing just makes my mind go in so many places. But yes, the warm-heartedness, the being alive, the empathy for, you know, so that faith doesn't become a mental exercise.
Yes.
as well.
Right.
Now you mentioned before the three things, accepting the Bible as God's revelation to humanity, the conversion experience,
right,
and the Great Commission.
Right.
It seems very empowering, and it seems to have a different sense of authority, for example, or different relationship. It seems, as from what you share, that an evangelical Christian is charged with spreading the word directly.
That's right.
Not going through structures, perhaps, as rigidly as in other faith. Could you share a little about that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good observation, Carol, and I think that gets at another real characteristic of evangelicalism, and that is a deep suspicion of institutions, I think, and that manifests itself in all sorts of ways. But historically, I think that comes from the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther, of course, unleashed his assault, really, against the institution of the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, which he thought had defaulted on the gospel or the good news in the New Testament. And so I think evangelicals inherit a lot of that from Protestantism generally. But there's also a sense, too, within evangelicalism that institutional structures, especially as they are represented by ecclesiastical hierarchies, tend to be stultifying. They tend to be and not conducive to piety. I think one of the suppositions, or one of the suppositions, not the right word here, but one of the prejudices of evangelicals is that institutions and even learning is inimical to piety, that institutions are rather poor vessels for piety. So you have an emphasis within evangelicalism on individual piety, so and in many cases, a kind of individualism that I think is probably in the end not all that useful to the faith, and I say that as a person of faith myself.
Yeah.
But also suspicion of institutions and governance. We don't want bishops telling us what to believe or how to practice. And the other characteristic of evangelicalism that follows from that is that because it's not bound to, say, liturgical forms or liturgical rubrics, it's not governed by hierarchical institutions.
Mm.
It tends not to be creedal in its definition. It allows evangelicals a great deal of latitude for experimentation. So if you go into evangelical congregations, you'll find a lot of innovation. They're not afraid to try new things. And if they're things are not working very well, they're not very popular for one reason or another, they're not afraid to abandon them. And that's one of the characteristics, I think, of evangelicalism, is the populism that has characterized it throughout American history.
Mm, thank you very much for that answer. Yes, and I imagine the more institutional a religious organization is, there's also a tendency for the people to sort of relinquish responsibility because of the authority that's higher up. So perhaps the responsibility of carrying it forward becomes something almost fearful.
That's right, and again, that's something that evangelicals inherit from the Protestant Reformation. I mean, Martin Luther, after all, said or taught what he called the priesthood of all believers. We're
right.
all responsible individually for ourselves before God, or rather than see ourselves as being mediated through the priesthood or through the church in general. And so, I think it's a two-edged sword, to be honest, because I think what it leads to is a sort of rugged individualism that is certainly characteristic of American life, or at least the way Americans like to see themselves in their own mythology. And what it very often means is the dark side, I think, is a kind of lack of accountability, where you have these kind of rogue individuals, and many of them preachers, who are accountable to no one and who kind of go off in their own direction without any sort of discipline or any sort of constraint.
Now, you also mentioned a couple of terms before in conversation there, Pentecostalism and fundamentalism.
Yes. Yes.
And how fundamentalists might be different. But let's just stop for a moment and go back to terms.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot to talk about.
So now, what would differentiate, then, the fundamentalist from the evangelical person regarding these three, you know, God's revelation to humanity,
sure.
and et cetera?
Well, I think that those... what I would insist is that they're all part of this, I sometimes call it an umbrella of evangelicalism. They're all beneath that umbrella of evangelicalism. But beneath that umbrella, there are a lot of differences and variations or different strains of expression. And another image to help us think this through is a big corporation like, say, General Motors, for example. General Motors is this big entity. It's not as big as it used to be, of course, because of the crisis. But within General Motors, you have GMC trucks, you've got Chevrolet, you've
right.
got I don't know what's left. I guess is Pontiacs. I don't know anyway. But you get the idea. The
sure.
different divisions, and so too within evangelicalism, you get this large entity that is defined by those three characteristics I outlined earlier. But beneath that umbrella, or within that term, you have a lot of different variations. You have, for example, the holiness movement, which was a movement that began back in the 19th century. And it took place at such places as Ocean Grove, New Jersey. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with this sort of place. Also, Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. These are two of the surviving camp meetings that are among many that have survived from the 19th century. Mm. But these were places of retreat where individuals could go and try to kind of revamp their piety or to restore their spiritual ardor. And so they could take that piety back to their own churches, their own denominations, their own communities, and serve as a kind of revitalizing force within that community. What happens with the holiness movement is that by the 1890s, it goes into such denominations as the Church of God and also the Church of the Nazarene. It becomes
right.
a part of institutional structure. And also the Salvation Army, by the way, is a holiness denomination. It's not merely a
right.
relief agency. It's also a church. It's also
yep.
a denomination. And the other part of the holiness movement then becomes even more radicalized, actually, after the turn of the 20th century, with the rise of Pentecostalism. And this is a story that, if you have a minute, I is worth telling.
Yes, please.
What happens with Pentecostalism, there are a lot of different origins for it, but probably the best-known story happens in Topeka, Kansas, on the first day of the new century, January 1st, 1901, at a place called Bethel Bible College. And the students at Bethel Bible College had been studying the Bible, which evangelicals do quite faithfully. And they were reading the second chapter of the Acts of the Apostles when, on the day of Pentecost in the first century, the Holy Spirit descended upon the early Christians, the early followers of Jesus, and they began speaking in tongues, and all sorts of miraculous things began happening. Well, these students began praying for the gift of speaking in tongues. They're also called glossolalia.
Right.
This sort of gibberish that it sounds like. It's actually quite beautiful and quite haunting when you witness this. But the understanding is that this is a gracious gift of the Holy Spirit. And these students at Bethel Bible College had been thinking about this and studying the Bible and praying for the gift of the Holy Spirit. And on New Year's Day, 1901, a student there by the name of Agnes Ozman, O-Z-M-A-N, I always get my students to remember this by saying, this is Kansas, so it's Oz. Agnes Ozman. Agnes Ozman began speaking in tongues on New Year's Day, and this was understood by both Ms. Ozman herself as well as her fellow students as the beginning of this Pentecostal visitation. The Holy Spirit was coming to Kansas. The movement begins to spread primarily through the travels of the school's founder and head, a man by the name of Charles Fox Parham. And he, as he travels, he tells people what's happening back in his school. And one of the people who hears him down in Houston, Texas, is a man by the name of Charles Fox Parham. William Seymour. Parham was the head of the school. William Seymour, who is actually African American. And William Seymour then in 1906 goes out to Los Angeles with this teaching. And this, one thing leads to another, but it triggers what becomes known as the Azusa Street Revival in Los Angeles in April 1906, when people began speaking in tongues, they began experiencing divine healing, and this is the birth of the Pentecostal movement in American evangelicalism.
What a great story. Word travels fast, right?
I'm sorry?
Word travels fast from Kansas to L.A.
What happened really was out of Los Angeles, people were coming to witness this because it was really quite a phenomenon, and the newspapers picked up on it and so forth.
Wow.
And people would come and they would receive this, what they called the baptism of the Holy Spirit, speaking in tongues and so forth, and then they would return and fan out across North America and even across the world with this Pentecostal message. And to this day, places like Africa and Latin America in particular, Pentecostalism is very big, very strong, because of the missionaries from the Azusa Street Revival.
Thank you, Randall. We are about halfway through the program already, and we're going to take just a short break. After the break, we're going to continue our conversation on evangelicalism with author and professor Randall Balmer, and perhaps we'll get into that hijacking as well, okay?
Okay.
After the break, you're listening to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. Here is a piece by the Singing Penguins, Change in My Life. Stay with us.
I've been misunderstood, I've been washed up, I've been put down, I'm told I'm no good, but with you I belong, God to help me be strong, there's a change in my life, since you came alone, oh, 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 oh yeah, now I do my to love you.
I've been misunderstood. I've been washed up, I've been put down, and told I'm no good. But with you I belong. God help me be strong. There's a change in my life since you came along.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're talking about evangelicalism and Christian fundamentalism with author and professor Randall Balmer. Randall, let's discuss now many of your themes in your work, which refer to perhaps fears and challenges of what might be known as the religious right.
Yes.
Let's talk about the religious right. First of all, now that we have a foundation of other terms, maybe we should define this one too.
Sure. And let me, if you don't mind, I mentioned two groups within evangelicalism earlier. I mentioned the Holiness Movement and Pentecostalism, and you would open that conversation by asking the difference between an evangelical and a fundamentalist. And let me just say a quick word.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Say that, as Jerry Falwell once said, that a fundamentalist is an evangelical who's mad about something. And it's not a bad definition.
Okay.
It's more a matter of temperament than it is any real divergence in theological belief or conviction. And just quickly, what happens with fundamentalism is that it emerges in the second decade of the 20th century. There was a series of pamphlets that were published between 1910 and 1915 called The Fundamentals that were a very conservative articulation of Protestant faith, tried in an attempt to stanch the drift toward modernism or theological liberalism in mainline Protestant denominations. And those who came
in America, you mean?
In America,
yeah.
Right, yes. The term belongs to American religion, even though it's been used now to talk about Islamic fundamentalists,
right,
and Hindu and so forth. But that's where it comes from. And those who embraced these doctrines came to be known as fundamentalists. That's where the term comes from. And they're known for, probably best known for their kind of militant attitude, as well as for their separatism. They want to separate away from other groups. For example, and a lot of people don't realize this, people think of evangelicalism as a sort of big united front, and it's not at all. Fundamentalists think that Pentecostals are, abhorrent is probably too strong a word, but not for some fundamentalists. They think that Pentecostals are beyond the pale. So
yes, that was one of the misconceptions I was hoping to clarify.
Right.
Yeah.
And getting back to your discussion or your question about the religious right, the religious right is a term that has come to be applied to a very loose coalition, and it is a loose coalition, of politically conservative evangelicals. Now, what I want to emphasize in talking about this is that politically conservative evangelicals are not all evangelicals, or to say it the other way around, not all evangelicals are political conservatives by any stretch of the imagination. Even today, despite the fact that the people that we tend to hear about and in the media and read about in the newspapers are those politically conservative evangelicals, there is another group that, in my judgment, has a long history in American life that is concerned about the issues such as poverty and hunger and the environment, the issues of war and peace and so forth. So the religious right would be those politically conservative evangelicals. And it's also, I think, important to say where this movement comes from and how it originates. The leaders of the religious right over the last several decades have been trying to peddle the story that they became politically active in direct response to the Roe v. Wade ruling on abortion in 1973. And it's a great story, but it is not the truth. And I've, shown this rather decisively in my research and my writings.
Where have you found it?
Well, I'm doing a lot of archival work.
Yeah.
is where I found this in places like the archives at Bob Jones University and Liberty University and all over the place. Presidential libraries and so forth. And the real story is rather different. It was a court decision that got them mobilized as a political movement. That is true, but it was not Roe v. Wade.
What was it?
It was a court decision at the lower at a lower level, the District Court, District of Columbia, a court decision held, handed down on June 30th, 1971, in a case called Green v. Connolly. And I don't want to get too detailed or technical here, but the background for Green v. Connolly was, by 1970, the federal government was trying to find ways to enforce the provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that forbade racial discrimination.
Ah.
And in so doing, the Internal Revenue Service issued an opinion that said, any organization that engages in racial segregation or racial discrimination is not, by definition, a charitable organization. Therefore, that organization has no claims on tax-exempt status. And what happens on June 30th, 1971, is that the District Court for the District of Columbia rules that the Internal Revenue Service is correct in that opinion. And the IRS, in the succeeding years, began to try to enforce that ruling, and after issuing warnings, began to rescind the tax exemption of institutions that still engaged in racial discrimination.
Hmm.
And one of the places they targeted was a fundamentalist school in Greenville, South Carolina, called Bob Jones University,
right,
which until 1971 did not admit African Americans to the student body. And until 1975, out of fears of racial mixing, did not admit unmarried African-Americans to its student body.
Hmm.
And that action by the IRS against Bob Jones University is what provided the catalyst for the religious right. It was only in the late 1970s, 1978 and 1979, that abortion became part of the agenda of the religious right.
And possibly a more, you know, a point that most people or more people would agree on rather than this one.
Well, I think it was. And actually, I think that's what happens, yes. I think what happened
better marketing.
Was, it
were.
Some ways it was. And actually what had happened was in 1978, in the Iowa Senate race, the incumbent was a Democratic senator by the name of Dick Clark, which is not that Dick Clark.
He's right.
He's Dick Clark, not the musician. He was running for re-election in Iowa against a fairly, or certainly a lesser-known Republican challenger. And everybody thought, all the pundits thought, that Clark would easily win re-election. And what happened in the final weekend of that campaign is that pro-lifers in Iowa who were Catholic, at that time pro-life was almost as synonymous with Catholicism,
right,
they leafleted church parking lots, and 2 days later, in an election with a very low turnout, Dick Clark was defeated and Roger Jepson was elected senator on the issue of abortion and pro-life. And I think that what happens then is that people like Jerry Falwell and certainly Paul Weyrich realized that abortion would work for them as a political issue, and they become attuned to that issue.
So there we are in the 70s with the birth of the politically motivated fundamentalist Christian,
right,
into our civic life here, political life, and is that has a trend that has continued in our culture.
It has. I think it continued really for 30 years, and I think, as a historian, I always want to reserve judgment on these sorts of things, but I think that in many ways the 2008 presidential election represented a turning point in that, first of all, looking at the numbers in terms of the polling data, it became clear that a far greater percentage of young evangelicals supported the Democratic nominee Barack Obama than had supported the Democratic nominee in 2004, John Kerry.
Hmm.
So what I take that to signal is a kind of generational divide among evangelicals in terms of the politics, whereas the older generation with the spokespeople like James Dobson and Don Wildman and Chuck Colson and so forth, Richard Land, resolutely insisted that the only salient moral issues were abortion and same-sex marriage. A younger generation in 2008 said, wait a minute,
there's a lot more to
broader
it than that.
spectrum of issues that are moral issues. And so they began to talk about things like poverty, hunger, the AIDS crisis, especially in Africa. They began talking about issues of war and whether or not just war was adequately consulted before the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. They began questioning issues of torture and raising them as moral issues, and in particular the environment. For a younger generation of evangelicals, the environment is a very, very important issue. And I think what we saw in 2008 is that this generation divide among evangelicals began to manifest itself. Mm. My sense of younger evangelicals as I traveled to evangelical campuses is that, for example, issues of sexual identity, they just don't resonate with the younger generation. I mean, if you press them about these social issues, they would say, well, yes, abortion is wrong, yes, homosexuality is wrong, but especially on the issue of sexual identity, there's just no real passion behind that statement, whereas they are willing to see a much broader spectrum of moral issues in the political sphere. And I think, in many ways, 2008... may have been, I always want to qualify that because I've been wrong before about this, I think may have signaled a real innervation of the energies of the religious right.
Now, one of the things that, of course, has impacted the younger evangelicals in a way that never has happened before, of course, is the technology today, the ability to communicate instantly and all the time and around the world. With the internet, of course, they see a lot more, they learn a lot more. You know, we tend to complain about youths always, you know, texting or whatever, but the reality is they are connecting all the time.
Yes.
And would you say that they also then have a much larger worldview then?
I think that's probably true.
And
I think that's probably true for all of us. But yes, I think it's much more difficult these days for parents to shelter their children from what's going on in the world. And I think you raise an important point there, Carol, because looking back on the 20th century, what happened with evangelicalism is that roughly in the mid-1920s, and I guess symbolically after the Scopes trial of 1925, what happens is that evangelicals kind of retreat into their own world, and they build their own world, what I call a subculture, and I've written rather extensively about this, a subculture of their own institutions. They had their own churches and denominations and Bible camps and publishing houses and Christian colleges and seminaries, missionary organizations and so forth. And the whole purpose of that, or much of the purpose at least, was to shield their children from what they regarded as the corruptions of this larger world that they came increasingly to regard as hostile. Mm. And what happened in the middle decades of the 20th century, and I can attest to this personally because I grew up in this world, is that it was possible for an evangelical child to grow up within this subculture and have, in fact, very, very little commerce or very little to do with anyone outside of that world or that subculture. It was really almost a hermetically sealed world and universe, and this is the universe in which I was reared. And what has happened, you're absolutely right, is that with advances in technology and so forth, it's much more difficult for these parents to shield their children from the world, which is why I think you see this kind of mania almost, and I don't want to be too uncharitable in my choice of words here, but this, I guess I'll say mania.
<I don't know.
laughs> Mania
for
homeschooling, to keep their kids out of the public schools and so forth, because they want to try to shield their kids, protect them from these dangerous outside influences. And frankly, as a parent, I understand that impulse very, very well. I mean, we all want to protect our children. But especially when you feel as though their eternal destiny is at stake, and many evangelicals would say that. it's an understandable response to that. But you're absolutely right. Technology makes it very difficult to pull that off.
But in a positive way, though, it also sensitizes them to that worldwide poverty, right? You know, right before their eyes. It's
I
real.
I think it does. I think it does.
You know,
and it opens them to this broader world. But you know, I mean, we're all shaped by our influences, and if what they're looking at is from a particular perspective, or even particular angle in the news or whatever it might be, then
yeah,
that will shape them as well.
So share a little bit now, if you would, a little more about what are the consequences of the faith being, as you say, hijacked, I love it,
yeah,
the word, by this, what we know as the religious right, and perhaps, you know, we don't know very much about it, and that's, if that's all we hear about, it's extremely limited, obviously. What are some of the consequences of this?
Well, I answer your question as a person of faith. I grew up as an evangelical, and I consider myself an evangelical today, although I'm always careful to define that term and define it away from what people usually associate with that movement, which is the religious right, which I regard as a real distortion of the faith. I think the consequence is that the faith itself has been compromised with its political involvement. I read the teachings of Jesus, and I read that Jesus expressed concern for the tiniest sparrow, for example.
Mm.
And to me, that has consequences for how I view the environment as part of God's creation. I read in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, turn the other cheek, love your enemies. And it seems to me that that has consequences for not only me as an individual, but for the kinds of policies that I would be willing to endorse or support in foreign affairs, foreign relations. I read Jesus saying in the New Testament that we need to care for the least of these in society. That has consequences, as far as I'm concerned, for how we treat the poor and how we deal with those who are hungry, not only here in America, but around the world. And when I see people who claim the same faith that I affirm taking that in a very different direction politically, I have to be careful not to be judgmental about that, and I don't always succeed, to be honest, because this is something so important, so precious to me. But I have to see this as some sort of distortion. And the other thing that I informs my view of the world is the fact that I'm a historian, and I look at the 19th century, and I see that evangelicals were at the forefront in the battle against slavery, for example.
Right.
Evangelicals were in the forefront of women's rights, crusading for equal rights, even voting rights for women.
The suffrage movement, right.
Evangelicals were concerned about peace. They were very active in various peace movements and organizations, trying to bring an end to violence in the world, and trying to mediate rather than use military force.
Mm.
I see evangelicals in the 19th century being concerned about issues like temperance, which today we look back and we see it as paternalistic and kind of overweening, but it was a very real response to very real social problems in the early part of the 19th century, where alcohol consumption was through the roof.
Right.
Something like 7 times per capita consumption of what we have today. Mm. And with that, a lot of social problems, including spousal abuse and child abuse and so forth. And
the very fabric of a family life, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So I guess what the reason I feel that my faith has been hijacked by the religious right is that I don't think that many of the policies that these folks are advocating in the political arena comport with the teachings of Jesus, nor do I think those policies are consistent with what I consider the noble legacy of 19th century evangelical political activity, which invariably took the part of those on the margins of society. And I simply don't see that sort of sensibility reflected in contemporary political activity.
Now, Randall, can you estimate, perhaps, how many people today would call themselves evangelical Christians?
It's hard to say. Estimates, according to polling data, range anywhere from 25% to 46% of the U.S. population. It's a huge, huge number and a huge slice of the population. If I had to guess, I would say it's probably in the range of maybe 35% to 40% of the population, somewhere
wow.
in that range. It's a huge movement, and it has been throughout American history. And I think one of the reasons that it has not been fully appreciated is that it's so hard to identify who these people are, in part because there's no one denomination, for example, that embodies them. In fact, most of the people who are part of this movement, I would hazard to say, I don't know if I have any empirical evidence behind it, but most of the people would be involved in churches that are non-denominational, that would not be part of, say, the Methodist denomination or something.
Right.
So it's very hard to get a fix on the numbers.
Now, this has been, your work, your life, your faith for so long now, and you've had quite a journey and an inspiring one. And if you could look back on your life and your journey of faith, speaking obviously just for yourself, is there one particular aspect of your faith or your spirituality that has helped you in living your life?
That's a great question. That's a wonderful question. I think a general sense of mystery. You introduced me at the beginning of the hour as a professor, and I'm a professor. I've been a professor for now, 26 years, something like that. So the life of the mind is very important to me, but the life of the spirit is also very important to me. I made a decision years ago that I would not allow the canons of enlightenment and rationalism be the final arbiter of truth. And what I mean to say by that is that I live and I choose to live in an enchanted universe where there are forces at play beyond my abilities to understand, much less to describe. And I wouldn't live anywhere else. My faith is important to me. My faith is central to who I am. And it's a faith that, believe me, over the years I've wrestled with. I've raged against my upbringing many, many times. But I've come to see it as a good thing. I think that part of my character formation has been in pushing up against that and the kind of strictures of my childhood. And to be honest, the challenge for me as an adult has been to come to terms with that faith, to appropriate that for myself without discarding it altogether. I've run into so many people who were reared as evangelicals, as I was, and who have just thrown it over entirely. You know, I'm agnostic, or I'm atheist, however they want to describe themselves.
Right.
And, you know, without judging them and certainly without minimizing whatever pain or anguish they've been through in coming to where they are today, there's something about that feels false or disingenuous or reactive, I guess is probably a better term.
Right.
And for me, the challenge has been to say, yes, I choose to remain a person of faith. I choose to live in this enchanted universe. And there's something valuable about that, and something valuable about the faith that I learned in my childhood. And I don't want to give it up. I want to cling to it, even as I reappropriate it and make it my own.
Thank you so much, Randall. And I love that phrase, the enchanted universe. If people in the audience want to learn more about evangelicalism and your work, your books, television productions. Can you tell us where they can go? Do you have website information?
I think I do, although somebody alerted me that my website had been hijacked. And it's, I don't
know. There's that word.
Right now. I'll try to work on that. It's www.randallbalmer.com. But as I said, the last I checked, it wasn't working properly. I'll try to work on that. My books are available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. And I guess if they're interested in evangelicalism in particular, the book that probably would give a flavor of that movement best of all would be a book called Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture in America. It's now in its fourth edition, and it was actually the basis for the three-part PBS series that we did on that book.
Yes, and we'll make sure to post all this information, too, on our website so listeners can follow you and your terrific work. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Carol, it's been my pleasure.
It's been a wonderful, informative, enlightening, engaging hour. And thank you once again, Randall Balmer.
My pleasure.
And thank you, audience, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to www.godspeedinstitute.com. We hope you enjoyed the show and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed.